Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. I want you to close your eyes for a moment and picture a tech entrepreneur. Who are you imagining? Bill Gates? Steve Jobs? Elon Musk? Were you imagining a woman when your brain conjured the image of a tech giant? Well, a nonprofit in Dublin wants to change how we imagine leaders in science and technology, adding more women to the field and more women to our collective imagination. It's called Cool Tech Girls, and its founder, Purba Majumdar? Oh, close. joins us now. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much, Anna. It's a pleasure. I'm so happy to be here.
About 7 out of every 10 people working in tech remain men. It is a sobering statistic as the mother of a daughter who's very into math, but it is one that I've been hearing about since I went to college. Why do you think this issue of women in tech remains, I guess, intractable?
That's a good question, because if you look at the numbers, you know, the number of girls entering into computer science field, that has actually gone down, you know, from 1985, which used to be upwards of 35%, to now less than 20%, is 18%, I think, in 2022. So that's really sad that, you know, we actually progressed backwards instead of going forwards. And I don't know, the reason maybe, you know, we're not giving that much encouragement to our girls, not creating that comfortable environment where they can, you know, truly be not afraid of trying new things. I would say those are some of the things, you know, because girls behave differently than boys. I mean, that's just a fact of life. So if we just have a cookie cutter kind of approach to educating girls along with boys, then when it comes to technology, there might be things that they're not willing or comfortable to do, which the boys are much more comfortable doing.
So that's where Cool Tech Girls come in. Can you tell us about your nonprofit?
Sure. So we started Cool Tech Girls about more than 10 years back in 2013. And at that time, my oldest daughter was in seventh grade, and she was just getting ready to experiment with different things, and I was trying to expose her to different types of programming. I would just take her to, you know, STEM type of classes or sessions or something like that, and then she told me one day that she didn't want to go there because, you know, she thought that everybody would look at her as a nerd and she will not have friends. And then I was very, very surprised because coming from, you know, originally when I came to this country more than 30 years back, I was a student. I was going to college. And I never thought that that's how, you know, my daughter would view things because back in India, STEM is a very popular curriculum. Men, women, girls, boys, everybody is super encouraged. So, you know, like now computer science and engineering are some of the major streams, career fields that usually kids go to. So I was very surprised why my daughter would think that way. And then I started talking to other parents and their moms and the girls' moms. And then they said that their girls also thought similarly. And so I thought that we should do something about it. And hence Cool Tech Girls. I thought we have to create an environment that's comfortable for them and start that conversation.
Yeah, your website notes that there's expected to be 3.5 million computer-related job openings by 2026, and about a fifth of them could be filled by people with computing bachelor degrees. So the jobs are definitely there. We just got to figure out how to motivate the girls to pursue them.
Exactly. I mean, right now, only 25% of the workforce, total computing workforce, are women. So we have a lot of work to do there. And that to the distribution or the demographics of that 25% is heavily skewed towards Asians or other types of, you know, groups. So I think that, you know, we really need to focus from when the girls are young so that we can see that difference.
Yeah. My daughter asked for an Ozobot. These are these cute little robots that follow paths that you draw with special pens. And like, I was like, oh, that's expensive. But then I was like, oh, you know what? We should really just get her the Ozobot because that like could be the gateway drug to more interest in STEM.
Absolutely. You know, finding like what they're interested in and having that connection with, you know, like the science or engineering or is really the best way to get them introduced, because we don't want to send them to a class and say, oh, you learned some kind of programming language or you just learned these concepts, because that's boring and they're not interested. So that's kind of, you know, one of the things that we focused on with Cool Tech Girls is how do we create programming that's more appealing to girls? And we came up with techno fashion, which is more fashion related, which is, you know, something that they would be able to relate to. And that's the reason, you know, kind of some of the programming that we do is a little bit different from some of the other, I guess, nonprofits or for-profits organizations focused in STEM.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about techno fashion, because you have a fall workshop coming up on September 22nd is when it starts. So it introduces girls to lessons in LED circuits and wearable technology. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that and how do we go about signing up?
Sure. So for the last few years after COVID, we are focusing on working with community partners. And we started with Hilliard Parks and Recs. And Hilliard Parks and Recs offered the techno fashion programs, and we taught the girls through that program, through their channel. So that's one way, you know, people can sign up for Cool Tech Girls programs. They ran the techno fashion, and now this year, techno fashion is being run by Gahanna Parks and Recreations. So the registration will be through the Gahanna Parks and Recs website, and they can find, you know, links to that. It's coming up 22nd, yeah. And then the Hilliard one this year will run in October, and those will focus on science experiments. So the girls who already participated in techno fashion can do other types of experiments. Yeah.
You also have a free STEM expo coming up. What is that? What would I get from taking my daughters to the STEM expo?
So that's a partnership with the 4-H group, and then it's a partnership with the OHIO. Ohio State's, program. So it's a program where they're going to have different organizations come in, as well as 4-H has their own programming. We will have a lot of different types of program throughout the day. And I kind of like the expos because the girls can be, exposed to a lot of different types of opportunities, and that might be, not everybody's going to be interested in one thing, but you know, it would be it will be comprising different topics within STEM.
I really love that you're trying to expand the definition of STEM for girls to think, oh, it's not just being a computer programmer. You know, we've talked on Tech Tuesday about the Nuvo ring that you wear, and it can like track your cycle mm-hmm. and your sleep and your heart. And it is this little piece of fashion with like a ton of technology built into it.
Yes. So through the techno fashion program, you know, the idea was to expose them to wearable technology, you know, because that's a newer field, lots and lots of potential. And we really want the girls to be excited to, you know, think about wearable technology, because in reality, they might already be using some of those. They just have to connect the dots. They just have to know that this is what it is and how do we introduce them. So that's why with techno fashion, we have the LED circuits and, you know, the conductive threads and all of that. And it's very easy. Like you have like stitching that you can do with LED threads, and then the circuits would light up. So that's very, very exciting. That's very, very exciting. And just the girls, when they create the earrings or the bracelets or the headbands, you know, they're just super excited. Like, you know, and they can wear them and they can use it for many different things, not just, you know, your earrings, bracelets, but it could be a T-shirt. It could be anything. In the techno fashion program, one of the girls came up with the idea of a tech. LED collar, dog collar that would light up during the evening time. Because oftentimes when you walk the dog and it's dark, then people cannot see. They might not be able to see. So this girl came up with that idea that she was going to make a dog collar made out of LED circuits. So I thought that was super cool.
It's about sparking their creativity, their imagination, really.
Right?
I mean, if you think about it, all of social media is built on algorithms and coding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if somebody's interested, if someone loves TikTok, you could be like, well, that's all math. Like, what makes that function is some very complicated coding.
Yes. And just for them to change the way they think, you know, is really important. Because oftentimes there are so many stereotypes. I think the girls are, you know, sometimes they are just taught this way that this is for boys and this is for girls, you know, and that's not really the case. Some of the girls that come to our program are so smart, but they just don't have that self-confidence sometimes to believe in themselves and to think that this is something that they can do. So that's where, you know, our programming gives them some exposure to these are the things that you can do. And also we have women role models who are teaching the program. So a lot of our volunteers are either women in different organizations or they are students from colleges. We have students from OSU. We have a partnership with the Department of Electro Science here at OSU. And actually, the concept of techno fashion came from Dr. Asimina Kirti. She's one of the assistant professors there. And it was her idea. And then she helped us develop the program. So we're trying to develop programs that are, you know, newer, that are going to be the things of the future.
That also sound really cool.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So you also have something called a candy data analysis event. What's that about?
So that's going to be so exciting. This one is going to be offered in partnership with T-Cetra, one of the company's local companies. And we're going to use the Halloween candies to do some graphing and, you know, some statistics with it, data analysis with it. So
like what is most given out type questions?
Yeah, right. So if you give them like candies, then they're automatically excited. And now you show them like how you can do some data analysis with that, or maybe doing some, you know, graphing and charting and all of that. So that's going to be a new program. Like, we've never done this before. So we're very, very excited. I think that girls will be super excited about this.
I like that. Halloween candy data analysis.
Right.
I hate to say it's like the sweet spot, but so are you guys looking to expand in any way?
So we have some foundation grants that gave us funding to develop CTG in a box program. And that's why we came up with the program. It's called the CTG in the Box, the same thing as Techno Fashion, but we have created videos, we have created instructional booklets and everything. So we are at that point where we can work with maybe another organization who wants to offer that program. We are, you know, trying to explore how we can go beyond, you know, Central Ohio and work with some of the other communities, and I think expand the partnership with the community partners, just like Hilliard, you know, is one of the partners. Deanna is one partner. We have more partners all over Ohio as well as outside. So we are definitely working on some more programming in addition to what we already do with Techno Fashion. And this part would be introducing the computer languages, like we will introduce them to Python, and then the Python will be used to control these LED circuits, you know, building the, like, how do you control the blinking of the LED lights with the help of code? very simple, you know, ways of. So that's the next project that we have. We definitely want to go beyond Central Ohio and Ohio. So if you are listening today and if you are interested in our program and you want us to work with you, please reach out to us. We'll be more than happy to expand this program, you know, to all over the country.
And the website is cooltechgirls.org.
Yes.
That was Purba Majumdar, the founder of Cool Tech Girls. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much, Anna. It's such a pleasure to talk to you today about Cool Tech Girls, which is my passion project.
Coming up, we're talking about Russian interference in the 2024 election. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. This is going to sound like a plot right out of a political thriller. A young couple sets up a media company in Tennessee. They have funders, and they line up conservative social media heavyweights who share theories about the election, immigration, and Russia's war with Ukraine. But the mastermind behind that operation is actually a Russian news network. On a mission to peddle misinformation and propaganda and influence the U.S. election in favor of Donald Trump. So this isn't a political thriller. This is an actual investigation by the Department of Justice. And joining us now to explain it is Andrew Kautz, Senior Editor for Security and Investigations at Wired. Andrew, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So for those who may not be familiar, can you explain who is Tenet Media based in Tennessee and what do we know about its founders?
Tenet Media is a company, I believe, founded officially in 2023 by Lauren Chen and Liam Donovan. They're married and they have a history of working with various media companies, including RT, the Russia state-backed media network, and they set out to start a right-wing social media network, and that's what Tenet Media is.
And so Tenet Media approaches some pretty big names in conservative circles. How do they get these very big names to work with them?
As far as I understand, they had some connections with these people in the past, and they set out to find some of the biggest names out there. I don't know the details of what those conversations looked like in the early days, but they were able to get some funding, and they were able to approach some of these influencers or social media stars, including Dave Rubin, Benny Johnson, Tim Pool, and later Lauren Southern. And they built this media network around those brands, though they had all those people had their own social media channels and presence online as well.
Yeah, and these videos were getting millions and millions of views on YouTube. And Tenet Media was compensating them, correct?
Yes, as we know from the DOJ indictment, at least two of the members of the Tenet Media Network received upwards of $400,000 a month plus some bonuses. I believe David Rubin has said that that's how much he received. Tim Pool received around $100,000 per video, which he produced weekly. And so they were definitely getting compensated very well, though they say subsequent to the indictment being made public that this was kind of akin to what they would be making with it, regardless of who they were working for.
So this was sort of their brand deal cost to work with a specific brand or a company. A lot of social media influencers say, like, this is my price for a video. This is my price for a product review. This is kind of how that world works.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know the extent to which that money was used to produce the videos, but I believe the indictment alleges that at least some of that money was used for that as well as compensation.
So then how does the DOJ come to be investigating Tenet Media?
So as I understand it, they have been investigating RT for a while now. They've been sanctioned following the Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. And I don't know the details of how it first came onto the radar, but certainly RT is an entity that the U.S. government is extremely concerned about, particularly in the wake of the 2016 election and the Russian influence campaigns that we saw during that election season. And so they've been keeping an eye on this network as well as the employees of this of RT.
And then they decide to file this formal set of charges, and there's this indictment document, and all of this comes out. And I mean, it feels like anytime the DOJ like goes after somebody and releases an indictment, I'm sure it's a big deal for the individuals involved. But I mean, the allegations here are essentially that they were paying these influencers, whether they knew it or not, to spread pro-Russian propaganda, essentially.
Exactly. And so the DOJ says that the influencers were not aware that they of the source of the money, but it does certainly appear that Chen and Donovan, who ran Tenet Media, were aware that they were working with Russians. The extent to which they knew their identities, we don't know. They were working under the RT employees were operating under aliases sometimes, and so it's really clear that from the what the indictment alleges that there was awareness on the Tenet Media's part, but not so much awareness on the influencers or the social media stars' part.
Yeah, I guess we should be clear that all six conservative influencers have said they had no idea and that whatever they were being paid was not to specifically say certain things.
Exactly.
So what is Tenet Media saying? Are they saying anything about this situation?
To the best of my knowledge, Chen and Donovan haven't said anything, and I don't believe any reporters have been able to get them on the record. The social media influencers themselves have come out and said, look, we're victims of this. We did this unknowingly, or we weren't aware of any plot to influence the election. So far, Tenet Media has been very quiet. They've not, as far as I know, posted any new content, though their TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram accounts have all been deactivated or removed by the companies themselves. They still appear to have an active Rumble account, which is more of a right-wing leaning video network similar to YouTube. But I don't believe that they posted any videos since the indictment was made public.
Now, there are some people who have been charged in this indictment with conspiracy to commit money laundering and violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act. I cannot pronounce these incredibly Russian names, but essentially there are some people who are facing very serious charges here.
Yes, at the risk of embarrassing myself, I'll try to pronounce their names. It's Kostya Kalashnikov and Elena Afanseva. And they are employees of RT, according to the DOJ. I don't know much about their background, but it doesn't seem as though they are particularly concerned about the DOJ indictment. RT has released some statements or posted things on their Telegram channel, basically mocking the U.S. process. And there's, in some ways, good reason for that, because it's very rare that when the U.S. charges Russians with crimes that they're actually prosecuted and you know, see any prison time.
Yeah, I don't believe either of them are in custody at the moment.
I don't believe so. And this is very akin to what you see with cyber criminal networks. You know, very often you have ransomware gangs and other types of cyber criminals that target non-Russian entities like hospitals or banks or other companies. And the Russian government essentially gives them a free pass to do that as long as they don't target any Russian entities. And so similarly, you know, this is this is a state-backed organization, RT, and so they're doing this with the express consent of the Russian government. And so you're not going to see cooperation from them in terms of any type of prosecution from the U.S.
Speaking of the Russian government, what has been the reaction from Russian President Vladimir Putin?
I believe the first thing that he did following the indictment was to endorse Vice President Kamala Harris, which many people view as more trolling than anything genuine. And to be clear, the U.S. intelligence community has consistently found that the Russians' agenda is to get President Trump elected, as well as to influence U.S. Funding of Ukraine and other, you know, other Russian interests there. So I don't know how much Putin has spoken about this particular issue, but it does seem that he's aware that he is kind of having some fun with it, I guess.
So Tenet Media's shows in recent months have featured some very high-profile guests. You know, Republican National Committee co-chair Laura Trump, former Republican presidential candidate from Ohio Vivek Ramaswamy, U.S. Senate candidate of Arizona Carrie Lake. So, I mean, they were pulling in heavy hitters in the Republican Party for these interviews.
Yeah, I mean, these are major media figures, and, you know, between all of Tenet Media's talent, they had millions of subscribers on various channels, and they're highly influential. And we can see the impacts of just how influential that media ecosystem is. If you're looking at the what's been going on in Springfield right now, obviously that was elevated to the stage of the presidential debate by former President Trump. But these talking points are very influential in that world. And sometimes if you're not in that world, it can seem like you're these things come out of nowhere. But this is what these guys are talking about all the time. And these major figures want to be part of that. They want to be either getting elected or be influential within that world. And so it's really important. It's no misnomer to call them influencers, because they are certainly influencing the political process in the United States.
And I think another way they influence it is they may say something, and then somebody else says it, and somebody else says it, and then it gets out into the public at large in a way that just feels like, oh, this is a fact of life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. These things get laundered through various things. I mean, we see, you know, posts on Facebook or 4chan or some of these other kind of corners of the internet get repeated and change and becomes a big game of telephone that it's very difficult to fact check, because it's often hard to figure out where the facts are coming from in the first place. And so very much is lost in translation oftentimes. And, you know, but they get repeated because they're powerful messages, whether they're true or not, or whether they're, you know, to what degree they're true or not true.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Springfield, like you said, is a recent example. They have sent, you know, increased police presence down for their schools, for the university there, for public offices, out of concerns of bomb threats and threats of violence. So, you know, whatever you believe to be the truth about what's happening with the Haitian population in Springfield, there are real life consequences right now for everybody who lived there.
Absolutely. It's a real tragedy that the people of Springfield are going through this, based on what by every indication are lies that are racist and should not have been elevated to the degree that they are in the first place. And now that they are, people take advantage of it. And whether the bomb threats that are coming in are from legitimate threats, or their kids swatting people and you know, doing pranks that are extremely dangerous, you know, that's the fact of life in Springfield right now, and it's a real tragedy, and I it's hard to see people going through that.
Yeah, a similar thing happened to Aurora, Colorado a couple of months ago in relation to immigrants. And then I just think even back all the way to, I want to say it was the 2016 election in Pizzagate, where an actual person brought a real gun into that pizza place because he truly believed that there was a child sex ring being run out of its basement.
Absolutely. I mean, this has been the nature of U.S. politics, at least in kind of the grassroots level to one degree or another, since there was the Gamergate situation many years ago. And that's where a bunch of video gamers were complaining about various things that, you know, centered on kind of feminism in video games and diversity in video games. And those conversations are still going on. You know, we at Wired did an investigation based on the closed captions of some 400 videos from Tenet Media and looked at what they were actually talking about. You know, what were the Russians actually paying for, essentially, according to the DOJ? And most of it is this culture war stuff. It's literally Gamergate 2.0. It's the Supreme Court. It's Elon Musk. It's less Ukraine. It's less, you know, some of these more traditional political issues. It's much more about kind of how we relate to each other and how we think of ourselves. And that seems to be what the purpose of RT's campaign to, you know, influence the U.S. election is, by creating division. And it's as personal as that can get. That's the point. It's the more personal it is, the more impact it can have on how people behave.
You know, at first blush, that seems a little surprising, right? That they're focusing not on why Russia is right to invade Ukraine. They are focusing on, you know, culture war issues within American politics. Like, that's what they're paying for.
Yeah, I mean, you see it every, it's inescapable, and it's impossible to separate the culture war, for lack of a better term, issues from mainstream politics. And we saw that very clearly on the debate between Trump and Harris. Just all the talking points that Trump was frequently bringing up during that debate were very much these kinds of issues, and they were much less the mainstream kind of policy issues or traditional policy issues that we might see being discussed. And it makes life very hectic for everyone, I feel.
Yeah, so as someone who has been studying, like, looking at this particular issue and looks at, you know, security and investigations for Wired, what advice do you have for people when they're seeing this stuff, either being shared by friends and family or they're coming across it in their own lives? Like, I just feel increasingly, and I'm somebody who is in the media, who's worked in media her whole career, it's getting harder and harder sometimes to tell reality from fiction.
It really is. And I don't know that I have any kind of silver bullet for how to address it. I'll speak personally how I deal with it myself. You know, I'd say one is pay attention to how things make you feel. And if it immediately sparks outrage or astonishment or anger or hatred, take a step back and look at what you're actually consuming and kind of where that's coming from, what the evidence is there, and try to just cool yourself down. And I think, you know, having a clear head is the best way to try to consume some of these things. You know, talk with the people in your life who about the issues, try to, you know, engage with it on a more personal level, so that in a constructive way, so that you're not just yelling at each other. I think that that's where these things a lot can get lost in the heat of discussions, and people kind of start to take sides and polarize themselves even within their own groups. So, I mean, I guess it's just be dispassionate about it as much as you can, and try to just think about it rather than feel about it, if that's even a term. And, you know, I'd say having a healthy dose of skepticism is good. However, I would say there is a tendency for people to stop at being skeptical. And I think, you know, I don't believe that skepticism itself when consuming media these days is a virtue. It's not the same as critical thinking. And it's a good place to start, but you need to just use the skepticism as a way to pause and then go forward and educate yourself with the facts to the degree that they're even attainable at this point.
I like that skepticism should be the jumping off point, because there have been so many headlines in this election cycle where I was like, that's not true. And then it turned out to be true. Unfortunately, we've had two presidential attempted assassinations. We've had a presidential candidate who dumped a bear carcass in Central Park. There's just been so many things where I'm like, that can't be real. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, it is real.
Yeah, it's really astonishing. I mean, I've been working in newsrooms since before Trump's first election, and it's really astonishing how wild the world is now. And I constantly wonder just why is everything like this? And I think, you know, the internet has not just divided the lines between what our online lives are and our real lives are, you know, offline, but it's allowed for a mishmash of people and issues and state operators and, you know, political influencers, whatever, to kind of get all mixed together, and everything just feels very bizarre right now. So I totally understand anyone who struggles to kind of separate fact from fiction, but I certainly do myself. And if it weren't my daily job, I don't even know how I'd be able to operate during this, in this current climate.
That was Andrew Coutts, a senior editor for security and investigations at Wired. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, Apple unveils the latest iPhone and some good news for Intel. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. After weeks of disappointing news like layoffs and declining stock prices, Intel is back with some positive articles. CEO Pat Gelsinger on Monday reaffirmed the company's commitment to its massive project here in New Albany. And they announced twin billion-dollar deals. Here to walk us through the details is Columbus Dispatch business reporter Mark Williams. Welcome to All Sides, Mark.
Hey, Anna. Good to see you.
Good to see you. So these announcements came as questions were growing about whether the Intel project here in Ohio would go forward as planned. So can you just walk us through what these announcements were and what they're going to mean for us here in Ohio?
So there were two big things yesterday. The first one was that okay, Anna, I think
You dropped out for a second. So just start all over again. You said the first one was...
The first one was that there were two big pieces of news yesterday. The first one was that Intel is going to receive an additional $3 billion in federal grants from the CHIPS and Science Act. And this is going to be for Intel to make chips for the Pentagon.
I think Mark keeps dipping out. What he was going to say is that it's going to make semiconductor chips for the
military,
Pentagon. Yeah.
For the Pentagon and the military, for military uses. And this is in addition to the grants that have already come from the CHIPS and Science Act and the tax credits and everything else. And then the second big news was this new partnership with Amazon, which basically makes Amazon and Intel are already neighbors there in New Albany anyway. But the deal was... The deal that's been announced is that Intel is going to make custom chips for Amazon's data center operations. And of course, we already know data centers are a big deal for Amazon in this part of the state. And they've made a commitment of several billion dollars to fill out their data center network in central Ohio. So you had the two big things there. And I think to me, ever since over the last 6 weeks or so, since the last earnings report, when
there you are again. We are definitely having some connectivity issues. But yeah, you said since the last earning report, it's been a series of unfortunate news events for Intel.
Yes. Yeah. So Intel announced, the big one was Intel was announcing the 15% cut in its workforce. And so I think everybody was like, you know,
Yeah, I think everybody was sort of worried, like, oh my gosh, are they collapsing as a company? Is NVIDIA going to take over? Are we even getting the plant? Have we just built a giant swimming pool in New Albany, essentially?
Yeah, well, I think that's what everybody was concerned about. And then this announcement yesterday, kind of Gelsinger, Pat Gelsinger, the CEO of the company, has made it abundantly clear from this announcement yesterday that it's all good forward for all of the manufacturing expansion that's taking place in the U.S. That's here in Ohio, here in New Mexico, in Arizona, and in Oregon. It would have been awfully...
Yeah, if they had backed out of this, it would have been pretty tragic. I mean, federally and state-wise, we could have gotten back some of that money. But when you're talking about all the infrastructure that we've already built out in New Albany, we've expanded the roads, we've put in all this extra, like, you know, fiber optic cable, like all of that has already happened. Like, there's no getting that money back.
Well, to me, this always seemed like an unlikely option already because of all the things that you decided, Anna, plus all the money that Intel has already spent, plus the federal, plus the state incentives, which are in the neighborhood of $2 billion that already has been awarded to Intel. And so this seemed unlikely.
Although it seemed unlikely, I mean, it's one of those never say never kinds of things because they have that call coming up, right? And although the manufacturing sector wasn't supposed to be on the call, like, you never know until you know.
That's right. And so but it was, I think everybody took a lot of reassurance from yesterday's announcement that the project's going to go forward. Anyone who's been out there can see already what's been going on with all of the cranes and everything else that had taken place out there. So it just seemed like a reassurance yesterday. Now, how long that's going to last, you know, that's going to be the question. Is this the start? Is the start of getting things going in the right direction? Or is this just an issue where we just get a short-term high and see how it goes in a few months?
That was Columbus Dispatch business reporter Mark Williams. Thank you so much for filling us in today. I want to pivot and talk about the new Apple iPhone 16. Last week, Apple announced their latest line of phones and all the upgrades to their existing technology. And here to walk us through that is New York Times tech reporter Trip Mickle. Welcome to All Sides, Trip.
Thanks for having me.
Real quick, though, before we get into the Apple iPhone, you also cover the chip maker NVIDIA. And I wondered what your thoughts were about Intel's announcement.
Look, it was, you know, the first ray of sunshine for Intel in a few months. They were in need of good news. They were really on the ropes from investors who had lost faith and confidence and kind of the roadmap for the company. And I think they were also being really scrutinized by the government about whether or not, you know, they warranted being the face of the CHIPS Act. And so for them to be able to come through with an infusion of cash from the CHIPS Act and the DOD, and then also coupling that with news that they have locked in a customer, especially one as high profile as Amazon, like that's great news for Pat Gelsinger and Intel. I don't think that means they're out of the woods by any means at all, but it did provide some hope that they're going to be able to, you know, get back on their feet and move forward in the near term.
All right, let's talk about the iPhone. So now there's an iPhone 16 and an iPhone 16 Plus. What are the upgrades? What's going to be different in this version?
Well, let's start by talking about what's going to be the same, which is not really answering your question. I mean, forgive me. But, you know, we're now 7 years into a phone that roughly looks the same, you know, right down to the way the camera looks on the back. The one noticeable difference physically in this phone is that it has, both in the iPhone 16 base model and then in the more expensive iPhone 16 Pro model, there is a new button being added that you'll be able to take photos with and then focus your camera with automatically on the side of the phone. So that being said, like if you go to an Apple store and you're looking at your existing phone and you're looking at the new phone, odds are you're not going to be able to tell a tremendous difference. I mean, the internals are going to be more powerful as they always are, but the real difference is what's going to be coming in the next month and the months ahead when Apple begins rolling out its generative artificial intelligence capabilities, which it calls Apple Intelligence.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But the way I've heard the camera upgrades described is that they're really for content creators. That the changes maybe like for average people snapping photos with their phone, but it's for people who produce content, particularly people who like, you know, turn it around to selfie mode and produce content.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly think, you know, you're going to have people who spend a ton of time in their camera. I think if we all really think about it, the most valuable aspect of our camera, of our phone right now, is the fact that it's a camera in your pocket, right? Like, you know, I've got a nearly two-year-old at home, and every once in a while he does something that I'm like, okay, well, he's walking around in mom's shoes right now. I really want to snap a photo of this. And, you know, fortunately there's a phone in my back pocket, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that just wasn't a possibility.
Yeah, the company is also unveiling some upgrades to its headphones, including technology that may help people with hearing loss. I found this really fascinating that the Apple AirPods 2 are going to get approval from the FDA for hearing loss.
Yeah, I mean, it's a new capability they're bringing to the AirPods Pro. You know, they are still AirPods, so, you know, it's hard to envision a lot of people walking around with these because they're so prominent and they're white and they're large and using those as hearing aids if they actually have a hearing problem. But you could easily see somebody in, like, say, you know, a loud restaurant maybe using them just for a moment in order to kind of supplement or augment their hearing. I mean, the capability that I personally was most intrigued by is kind of connected to that, and that's the ability to pop in your AirPods Pro at a concert, which are often very loud, and have it refine and kind of adjust the sound levels so that you don't have as much hearing damage. And as somebody who's a music lover, I thought that was a really wonderful capability that they added.
Yeah, and I will say that if, you know, we have now started to have over-the-counter hearing aids. And, I mean, Apple AirPods 2 are not cheap. They're about $250. But they are cheaper than probably the cheapest hearing aid on the market.
Right. And so maybe the upside of this is, you know, just kind of, you know, age-old capitalism, right? Like, if something comes to the market at $250 and people see some dual use out of it, maybe it'll encourage some other hearing aids developers to make a lower price iteration of more discrete hearing aids that serve that purpose kind of 24/7 for people with hearing damage or hearing loss.
They also are advertising their new AI component. So this is going to be a pretty big deal. It can create, I guess, summaries of transcripts that you record, help with writing prompts. Is this just kind of going to be like a Siri on steroids?
It's going to need to be more than Siri on steroids, right? We've had Siri around for a decade and change, and Siri is like disappointed a lot of people for a long time. You know, it was introduced in 2011, shortly before Steve Jobs' death, and it was going to be the virtual assistant in your pocket that helped you do everything. And if anybody saw the last season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David devoted a whole like 3 to 5 minutes to like yelling at Siri for being completely and utterly incompetent. So it's gonna be more than that. It's gonna be an improved Siri. Plus, it's gonna be other features on the phone, like pulling up a website and seeing an article and saying, "Hey, summarize this for me in a tap of a button." Things like that are gonna be the real kind of experiences that people could find valuable as they get these capabilities onto iPhones.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I have an app that will read articles off the internet to me using an AI voice, but like summarize this long thing into like 2 or 3 paragraphs, that would be different.
Yeah, and it's going to be able to do that. There are going to be writing capabilities that you'll see across the entire suite of apps that you have. So even say in Slack, you're writing a note to your boss who's hounding you first thing in the morning. Not that that's ever happened to me, but maybe you're a little, you know, feistier than you intend to be. As you tap out that first message, there'll be a prompt that can come up on the iPhone that says more or less, professionalize this for me. And it will edit it and make it a bit more kind of straightforward for your boss. So you're not firing off some missive first thing in the morning.
Now let me think. There's a whole genre of TikTok videos devoted to, like, how do I say, you know, go do whatever to yourself, but in, like, corporate speak.
Yeah, yeah. There's Siri's going to be able to help with that. what Apple's essentially saying, right?
Yeah, I saw the preview, I think, a while back of the calculator, where I don't know what teachers are going to do with that, where, like, you can write out the formula and it's going to solve it for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It had everything about that moment where you're writing on an iPad and, to your point, like, the math is being done automatically for you. It had all the touchstones of it just works, it's magic, it's Apple, right? I mean, that kind of is the essence of what they've been about for a long time.
Yeah. That was Trip Mickle, a reporter with the New York Times. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you all to listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.